Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Welcome to Experience Focused Leaders. Today, I'm joined by Brian Liu. Brian is the founder, CEO, chair of LegalZoom, the company that helped redefine access to legal services and ultimately became a first publicly listed legal tech company from a startup era of late 90s. Brian, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm really excited. I've had the privilege of hearing you advise some other startups on a board that we advisory board that we shared.
Yep.
And when I heard that, I said, hey, first of all, I could benefit from some of your advice. And also our audience would love to hear your story and the rich experience that you bring. So first, just tell us, how do you go from arguably the most conservative profession, law, to trying to disrupt it with a startup back in the days when, you know, startups weren't that hot, you know, you were the pioneer.
Well, I think it's a funny story, Alex. I think, you know, from the first days of law school, you know, I met one of my best friends, Brian Liu, who was my other LegalZoom co-founder. We met on the first day of law school. And I think we were immediately drawn to each other because we both looked at each other and we said, what are you doing here? Why are you in law school? I don't know. Why are you here? And so we kind of formed a bond because we knew that we weren't going to be practicing lawyers forever. And that was not, I was never really our intention of going to school. I think for me, it was like I didn't know what else I was going
to
do after.
Was it to please your parents? Come on, let's go there. To prove to something to them?
I'm sure that had a little to do with it, Alex. Well, you know,
I've been there with my business school thing, so I got it. I was thinking like I might go to law school because, you know, I don't know what else is there to do, and then. Yep. And then somebody told me, unless you want to be practicing law.
Well, you know, so after law school, I did. I practiced law for a couple of years because you have to learn what's going on. And they were really good because law school teaches you one thing over here. Then being actually an attorney at a big firm or even, you know, at a small firm, it doesn't matter. It's something entirely different. It's over here. And that's why. And that's why we actually started LegalZoom, because I knew there was a huge disconnect in terms of what people actually needed and what people, you know, the average American, what they were looking for and what they were teaching you in school and what you're doing at a big law firm. I mean, it's just completely disconnected.
And what
the last thing, let me tell you something funny. The last thing they actually teach you in wills and trust class, because you are supposed to take wills and trust in estate planning.
Which is like what the most useful, is that like the most practical class besides divorce law for most Americans?
It's not, because the last thing they teach you is how to actually write a will.
Okay.
No idea. You learn all of the theories and all the weird situations, but you don't know how to do the actual basic thing.
Wow. So it sounds like it is really an academic, and it is an academic training, not a practical applied training.
Absolutely. Okay. So that's where, you know, what we always say, and I think this is still true, is we never went out to try to, you know, like get lawyers out of the job or take away their business. It was all about creating additional access. It was about democratizing the law, because we knew that there were lots and lots of people who didn't have or didn't want to pay the amounts that the lawyers were charging. And I mean, and there's good reasons why the lawyers charge the amounts that they do, because they have their own liability. They have so many more things that they have to think about. And it's just, you know, they can't undertake those particular services without charging as much as they do. And so we wanted to, you know, open up the market, open up the access for just everyday individuals, everyday Americans, so that they can, you know, get the protection of an LLC when they start a business. They can write wills on their own. They can trademark their names and products, and do that without all the additional costs and baggage that it comes when you're using, you know, a professional lawyer. But there are always good reasons why you need to go to a lawyer as well. And we acknowledge that at the very beginning. And that's why we've always at LegalZoom, we have, you know, lawyer assisted services as well on the platform.
But through the news, I kind of heard there were some challenges for your business from the institutional legal kind of system. Yeah. How did you handle that? How did it feel? On your kind of journey, relatively young founders, right? That was your first adventure. What's it like? You know, because is being a lawyer trained as a lawyer prepares you for conflict in building a startup, or is that like, did that feel very personal as a founder?
It's tough, Alex, because we knew that if we got challenged too much at the beginning, I mean, it could bring us under, because we didn't have the resources to defend against a lot of these actions. So we tried to stay under the radar as much as we could, but that wasn't really possible when we had Robert Shapiro as our co-founder and we were doing so much PR with him. So,
and just for our audience, Robert Shapiro, that's not Legal Eagles. Robert Shapiro was
O.J. Simpson attorney.
O.J. Simpson's, right? Like the glove, the glove doesn't fit, right? Okay.
Yep. He was part of that. He organized the whole dream team. And so we had him as one of our co-founders. And what he insisted that we do was that we had to basically, you know, get an opinion. This is hard. We had to get an opinion from a law firm saying that what we were doing was, you know, supportable, that it was legal, it was legit. And California luckily had a law in the books for a quote legal document assistance. And we were pretty good at sticking to those rules. And then, you know, that was only in California. How we operate in other states, you know, of course, other states gave us, you know, sometimes some problems. They investigated us. But at the time, I think the core of what we did was we were filling out legal forms. And the idea of creating legal templates, filling the blank forms, those have been around for more decades and decades. You know, if you remember, they used to have bookstores where people would go and you can buy these books on how to draft your own will. I mean, NOLA would have series of these books, and there literally were tear out forms in the back of these, or you can fill it in, type it in, and you can make your own legal documents.
I mean, so you're like legal docs for dummies with forms that kind of get filled out.
Yes.
And kind of unlocking that lower end of the market while creating room for premium services for attorneys. And
there was software at that time. Quicken actually had something called like Willmaker. It's a software product that they made. And, you know, all we were doing at that time was introducing that and putting it online as opposed to making it a static product. That was our main thing, because you could, you know, with a book, you got 100 pages, right? And who's going to read 100 pages just to do a simple document when we can help you do that online in 15 minutes? The software product, of course, you update it all the time. You don't know if you're, you know, you didn't know if it was outdated or it was already too old. So if you bought the software and you didn't have the, you know, the internet connections were not always great at that time either.
And so when you think about the evolution to today's world, right, fast forward where, you know, we have Harvey and then Claude one day disrupts Harvey, and there's, you know, still like in the last few years, a number of legal legal tech AI unicorns just emerged. Mm-hmm. What has changed and what remains the same in your view?
Boy, what is the main thing I think that's changed, Alex, is that finally the legal practitioners, the lawyers, the actual end users are demanding that lawyers utilize technology, that they rely on, you know, something else, that the clients are demanding this.
And these clients, are they consuls at companies, or are they small business owners that don't have?
Small business owners, of course, they're always a little bit more willing to take some risks on their own to save money. So they've been early adopters of this. I mean, between AI drafting, you know, simple legal documents for them now, or, you know, doing even more hardcore, but heavier types of levels of work. I mean, they're.
Brian, I think I lost your sound here for a second. Let's try. Let's see.
Are we okay?
Now we're okay. All right.
Okay. Okay. That's okay. I'm sure you'll do some editing there.
I'm sure AI will do some of that.
Yeah, AI will do some editing
there. Maybe it will make me look handsome as well. We'll never know. All right. So no, we are in regulated content here. So we're taking this year. So basically your group that you were targeting, the small business owners, the individuals, were always more eager to innovate because of the cost constraint.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what you're saying is what's changed is the B2B component.
Yeah.
The enterprise component was that historically has been, you know, premium services, lots of fees, lots of folks straight out of law school supporting partners.
Yeah.
And now that's changing, right?
You know, yes, that's changing completely. And interestingly, I think one of the reasons it changed is because the large law firms kept on increasing their fees. They kept on increasing them and increasing them. And the clients are like, we got to cut down on some of these fees. So they're demanding that the firms be more efficient and that they adopt AI. And I think some of the larger firms are going to fight, and, you know, they may fight this for a while, but it's going to be difficult because it's not just AI. There's alternative structures and alternative legal providers, even in the US, that's been working to help some of these, some of these companies, things like Axiom and these other types of distributed, you know, legal models, more like almost like additional in-house legal support models that are out there that are helping
bring the cost down, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So like from one perspective, this makes perfect sense. But then when I look at, you know, a few years ago, prior maybe to a complete AI takeover, there was an attempt by very well-known entrepreneurs to build something called Atrium, which was gonna, you know, disrupt all those costs, especially starting in the Silicon Valley.
Yep.
And then it like notoriously like had all the best investors, great team, and then just something went wrong. What's your observation of where have attempts to disrupt this have gone wrong in the past? Maybe it's this one, maybe some others that you've had your eyes on. And why, what's changing now? Is it just the technology that's democratizing it, or it's like that pressure? Or is it like some perfect storm that's happening that's making it all work?
It's very interesting, very relevant what you just asked, Alex, because what I used to tell people all the time is, you know, your venture into legal tech or compliance tech, it's, you know, congratulations, thank you for doing this, but this is going to be a thank you for your service, because this is not going to be an easy journey. You're not going to find a lot of investors who are really interested You might have to do a lot of bootstrapping.
Yeah.
You're going to have to reach down deep many times, and you're going to have to ask yourself, why are you doing this? Is this something that you are doing purely because you think that it's financially lucrative? Is there something else? What's your core reason for doing this? And I remember, as we kind of like, who knows, this is like, the date today is like the day after. It looks like we might have another, world conflict on our hands. But I remember specifically coming into the office, during that morning of the 9/11 attacks, 25 years ago. And we were only in, we started out a year and a half ago. And I remember talking to my other co-founders and saying, geez, I mean, this, we don't know what's going to happen. What is going to happen in this world? I mean, we're here, we're doing a legal startup, but there's so many other things going on. And you really think, why are we here? Why are we doing this? Why don't I have just a stable job when in the midst of chaos, I'm trying to pay for my house and everything else? Like, there's so much uncertainty. And you have to know why you are in that. So that was always been the traditional, like the key for success for me for a good legal tech startup, that the founders really know why. I think what's changed in the last year and a half, 2 years maybe, is that all of a sudden, private investors are really, really interested in this whole legal tech space and legal tech adjacent space. It's become like one of the darlings of the investment world. So what's great about it is that you have a lot of people who were not lawyers, who don't have any, legal background, and who've decided that this is a great area for disruption, for improvements, for democratization. And they've come in with a different new perspective on things. So that's really great. And also for the existing founders, now there's a lot more access to capital than there was before. So I think it's still really relevant why, you do something. I think it's always relevant. But what's great is that there is additional support out there. So it doesn't feel like you're entirely on an island anymore.
Got it. So there's going to be likely more innovation because the breakthrough, the profession kind of had it coming because it had to, it kind of stayed pretty resistant to change, at least in some pockets, right? Not your bottom up pocket, but the higher echelons, and their fat margins led to customers. So there's that pressure, and then was one breakthrough success story, plus it lends itself well to LLMs. There's kind of think this is the time to break through, and then everybody's jumping in. And what's your take? Are the people that are tourists, sort of like I had a bad experience with a lawyer, I got overcharged, I didn't get, and I'm gonna go fix that, right? Because that's like oftentimes the founder motivation, right? Like I couldn't get a taxi on time, so is like, are these folks, are they, what's your take? What's gonna happen? Are they gonna stick it out with, go through the challenges? Is there gonna be consolidation?
I mean, I think that's not unique to just legal tech. I think it's true for pretty much everything, right? You got to know why you're doing something. I see this like, for example, in the restaurant industry. I mean, completely different. But if your idea was, I'm going to start a restaurant to make some money because, oh, I've always liked to do this and I think it's kind of fun, you're not going to survive. You have to love doing this. This has to be something that's a passion that you've had, that's deep. It's much deeper than simply, oh, I like trying new places and I've always wanted to do this. And because I have a couple friends who've done that. And without that deeper why of why they're getting into it, it's just not going to survive the first time you face hardship. And you're bound to face hardship multiple times.
Well, talk to us about what happens when you're going through these hardships, right? Like LegalZoom was nearly 20 years for you.
Oh, Yeah, I was CEO for the first 7 years. I stayed on as chairman for the next, executive chairman until 2012, and then I was on the board as the chairman until, geez, I can't even remember.
2018, I think. The bio says 2018.
2018.
So that's a long perspective. A lot, like what, 20 crises per year probably that you kind of an average or something like that.
Lots of challenges, lots of crises, lots of, luckily we didn't have anything, as I look back on it, that was an existential threat. I mean, we definitely had a lot of problems and issues, but nothing that it felt like it was, like life or death threat, but definitely challenges. When you have, I'm just gonna laugh at this one. There's a certain state that I will not name that accused me of illegally practicing law without a license.
Okay.
And then it was a criminal complaint.
Okay.
And like, the only thing I could say is that I've never been in this state. I will never travel this state. I will never fly over this state.
Right. Right.
But somebody in a different state is threatening to put me in jail because of, what we're doing. And it was like, I mean, I pretty much ignored it, and I laugh about it now because
but at the time when you were speaking to your partner,
and they came after
was that
me,
a laughing matter?
Like,
was that a laughing matter or did it feel
it
bigger?
Was more of like, okay, I'm never gonna go there, but how, really? Really?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, it could happen,
Yeah.
right? You get arrested for driving for over the speed limit, and then they look, oh, we got a warrant for your arrest, by the way,
Yeah.
and you're going to be in jail for who knows how
Yeah.
long
Yeah.
for illegally unlicensed practice of law.
So when you so
I'm
you
not
say
mentioning
okay,
the state because they're going to get angry at me.
yeah.
I'm still afraid to go there, by the way.
You're
Okay,
still, you're still, you're, you
that's
never
how
know.
bad it
You
is.
never know. Yeah.
They know where I am. They're going to come after me. Forget it.
So when you think about existential risk, we're gonna the it, when you was a was a perspective of time. Right now, you've seen your journey, other companies you helped found, your advising companies. It was a perspective of time. Few things seem existential, right? Like, but at the time, especially if it's the first exposure to a particular type of crisis or risk, it probably felt different. And I'm curious what you felt like. Where did you find the perseverance and the faith, the discipline, the pause, almost whatever, your meditative break to go and like restart, deal with it versus react? Because I would say for myself personally, I noticed at some point something happens at work. I don't like it. I hide it at work, but then like my daughter comes up with some late request and I go, I'm like, there's something that comes out and I'm working on it, right? But it's not an obvious thing of like, how do you process all that stress that you get as an entrepreneur going through disrupting industries?
Yeah, look, we what was probably existential at the time was we had a lot of investigations instituted by state attorney generals and different bar associations and things like that. And we had to go and allay their fears. We had a team, my general counsel, Chaz Ramathal, who was really, really great at this. And, he was a former Navy pilot. And
Right.
he was just, the type of guy that when you walked in to these committees and they asked, what do you do? He was really good and authoritative to saying, like, we know where the lines are and we don't cross those lines. And I think one thing that we found is that the more we were able to get in front of these different bar association committees and attorney generals, we showed them who we were. And we were really, we're not trying to be shady. We're not trying to put lawyers out of business. We're really doing something, one, that's good for the general public. And two, we actually do want to help the lawyers out as well. And we're integrating them into our platform. The more we you know, were open about that and open to their suggestions and open to dialogue. I think that was a realization that we had. We thought it was going to be more of a fight, but it turns out that open lines of communication were much more important.
So speaking of as a kind of this open line of communications, what would you say were your challenges as a leader when you were starting out, you know, and now that you're advising others, right? You've had more of a perspective, you know, as a chair, you kind of you have a steward role, that you say, hey, I wish I could talk to my younger self and, you know, address that or this issue earlier, right? Like advice to younger Brian and all of us who are kind of in our pre-IPO journey right now.
I mean, definitely, this is where, you know, from my background and everything else, it's people tend to think all the times it's them, it's their ideas that make something successful. Most of the time, it is about the organization, the people that you have, the other people that you know, and learning all these people's skills. I mean, that's what actually tends to make something successful. I wish that, you know, a little off the tangent, but when I was in law school, I actually applied for business school. I wanted to do a joint program. They didn't let me in.
Their
And
mistake.
they didn't let me in because they said, you know, you have to understand, Brian, the business school is not about the subject matter. It's not about learning finance or accounting or marketing or anything else. It is about learning how to deal with others, how to work together in groups. And that's the, you know, and those, you know, learning finance is just a way for you all together to get together and
Right.
learn how to work with each other. I understood that, and I wish I did more to grow that part of me like a long time ago. I still wish I could do it now, but I feel like I'm getting too old to learn new things, you know. But
Brian,
yeah.
let me tell you something. I did go to business school. In fact, I went to two. I even did an undergrad and an MBA. And I liked what they were saying. And I thought I understood what they were saying about that, right? But I don't think you internalize it until you make a few omelets where you break some eggs, right? You know, and I think but I would like so because I think in our pop culture, right, from when we think law profession, like, and also the types of people that get attracted to business, there are people who want to win, right? I want to win with my ideas, you want to win the case, right? Like, there's that, and I think there is a relatively simplistic narrative in our culture about winning and losing, right? That's why we like the legal dramas, right? Like, there's that satisfaction towards the end. And I think what you kind of highlighted is very powerful, is like the winning the argument is not necessarily going to help the relationship and the bigger aim of building something, right? And I think as a CEO, obviously you have a lot of power, right? You could win things through a number of ways, right? And you're a very clever guy. But I think what you're saying is it's knowing when to use that muscle and when not to. Is a journey.
Absolutely. And you know, we think in our culture that there's some, you know, exceptional entrepreneurs and founders who've started these, you know, giant mega caps all by themselves, and it was all them, and everything was all them. But I guarantee you, none of them would have been successful if they either weren't able to, you know, attract other people with their vision, to recruit the right people to sell that vision. You have to communicate that to somebody else so that other people believe. And then, you know, you're not personally, like, I'm sure Mark Zuckerberg, after a while, was not personally writing the code for Facebook. He was not personally figuring out the algorithms, you know. I'm sure he had a leadership role in it, but he was maybe, I mean, all these things that happened, they were not always just ideas of one person.
Yeah.
It took a group of people, of really smart people to follow this person, that vision, to get to where they are.
So you're what you're talking about is really feels like trust, right? Like that we trust in you as a leader, and then you trust us as individuals that we're going to work together to accomplish something.
Overall leadership. Yep. And that's the type of leadership skills that you don't learn. You don't certainly don't learn that as a subject area, subject matter in school. I don't think there's classes that really teach you, and then you just kind of go out and do it.
Yeah, there is no class on trust even in business school. But and I, what I found is that was interesting is one of the most popular classes at Stanford was called Interpersonal Dynamics, or popularly known as touchy-feely, and it talked a lot about influence. You know, how do you be vulnerable or share certain things to influence others? And I think that's great, but it, even that had a little bit of a transactional vibe when we kind of reflected on it. You know, as I was time, I reflected, and I think it was a good start of becoming more self-aware on these topics. But I think if you start with a goal to transactionally influence somebody, you know, you're gonna people are not dumb over long relationships, right? Like that's why, like, you're deep passion about what you're building is important because that's authentic, right? And so yeah, maybe you could learn some skills. Like, okay, I'm gonna keep my palms open right now. You know, you're gonna trust me now. You know, we're like, but like that's sort of maybe a behavior, a good habit to acquire. But that is not, if you go into that with a purpose that I'm gonna manipulate Brian, right? Like, people will smell through that stuff. So I think it's something has gotta like go to that level of depth of where you're trying to build real long-term trust, work towards a common goal. And I want to bring that, you know, if you could comment on that, but also in the context of what are a lot of our audience is working in regulated industries. They're working with compliant communications. And our view is that the focus should be there to build the trust between the creator and their audience. And if you do that, everything else will work out. But you can't build trust by, you know, creating a wall of information and hiding behind small print, right? That's not a trust build. That may be legally required, but it's not a way to build trust. So you kind of have somehow need to make things accessible. You know, make you know, be c both compliant and relationship building at the same time. What are your thoughts on like building in this world where trust is, you know, obviously not a commodity that you find not just in startups, right? But like all around, like there's a lack of trust.
So I think, look, one of the things that everybody is facing right now is whether AI can kind of take over what they're doing.
Right.
And that human trust element is really important, I think, because from whether it's a user or anybody else, they want to have this, we lump a lot of things into this idea of trust. And one of the main components that goes into it, I think, is understanding the humans, the human impetus, the reason why, again, why you're doing something. Like for an example, right? I talk at LegalZoom. It was about, support for us. One of the our missions is to support that entrepreneurial journey, and not just to support it, but to really, be on their side. I mean, our whole idea was that we want to put the law on your side. We put this into our slogan, and we did that as part of the PR and part of the story behind it, because people remember the story. And the story, of course, is that, we are also business owners. We're entrepreneurs. We understand how you feel. We're going through that. We're trying to make your journey easier, because that also fulfills our mission. We want everybody to have these benefits of the law so that they can spend less money on these legal matters, more money on their business. And we're here to support you along the way.
Got it. So you weren't building trust by having extra long form that they had to fill out waiving liability.
Right, exactly. It's coming up with authentic stories, authentic reasons of why you are doing something, and again, story there is that, my dad was a small business owner. I saw what he did for our family when he started this business. He was working, at another company, and then he went out on his own. And then, from the first days, I remember going to his office. And he rented this office in Pioneer Square in Seattle. And he had four desks in this office, four desks. He showed us this office. And I was like, Dad, you're here. You've got three other desks. Why did you get these desks? Did you rent them? Why is the office so big? You're the only person here. And he said, you know what? Those desks will be filled. We're going to have more people come. And they're going to be sitting in them. I bought those desks because they will be here. And you see that, you feel that. And that's something very different. I think humans have the ability to feel that from people. It's not a logical thing. It's an intuition that they have. And when they see that you get them, you understand what they're going through. You're here to help them in that genuine sort of way that feels authentic. And it's like you said, it's not something you read from a book to influence people, not doing it just to make money. That is how you build loyalty. That's how you build trust. That's how they're like, Alex, look, we're going to be here for you because you're here for us. And that, by the way, is one thing I think I hope that people will see through that AI is not able to do that. They can do things, but they will never have that, they never will have that empathy, that bonding.
That care, authentic care, right? They will sound,
And they're very good at making it sound like, oh my God, that's such a great idea, Alex. Hey, we really feel for you. But you know it's not authentic. Because it doesn't have a story.
What a beautiful mic drop, Brian. Authentic, caring, and storytelling.
Yeah.
As a way to describe the most legal, compliant, process-driven profession.
Yeah.
Right. And I love how you connected it back to being a 7-year-old. And your dad. I think that's an amazing story. Brian, what's as we wrap up, last kind of words of wisdom for our audience as they are embarking on bringing that care and trust and storytelling into their communications. What can you share that you wish you had learned to get that to that IPO faster or to have avoided a few sharp corners?
Those are all some of the things that we went through. I'm happy that we did. I'm happy that there were certain delays at certain times. I mean, we had difficulties with some of our early investors. I don't think we were ready for an IPO early. There are a lot of things going on. We actually filed for an IPO in 2012 before actually having the IPO in 2021. So, I'm kind of happy that that didn't happen because I don't think the team was ready for it. We weren't ready for what it was going to take to be a public company with the stock where it is. It's a tough situation. I'm not sure if IPO is always the best way.
Always the right way. So basically be acceptant of the journey, right? Like accept the journey because sometimes we feel like we want to force it.
The journey, I mean, as long as it's not too painful, the journey is always great. A few challenges is what makes, that's what you remember. You remember those challenges. You don't remember those days where everything just went perfect. Nobody remembers those. I mean,
yeah,
you remember certain milestones, the first time, you know, whatever, the first $1 million, first $1 million day, or whatever. You'll remember those milestones, but you'll remember the challenges and how you overcame those challenges a lot more.
Beautiful. Well, Brian, I will remember this conversation. I'm really glad our journeys crossed, and I'm glad that we've shared your wisdom and experience with our audience. Thank you so much for coming on board.
Thanks, Alex.
All right.
Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relateto.com, R-E-L-Y-T-O.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relateto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, S-H-E-V-L-E-N-K-O. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.